afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call a meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Thursday, February 16th, 2017. Welcome, everyone. I was going to introduce each county commissioner by name, but there's a whole slew of you, and we'd be here for an hour. So welcome, everyone who's visiting us today. We're going to go a little bit out of order. There are some folks who need to get to another hearing, so we're going to start by opening a public hearing on HCR 1.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 1 designates certain cities as Medal of Honor communities or cities. It comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, good afternoon. John Huffman, State Representative from House District 59. My job today is playing a role for AOC to show the county commissioners how quickly you should get a hearing done. That's my role today. Actually, I'm Josie's arm candy today, and this is my bill that, you know, Dick and I have worked together on veterans bills, along with Gene and everybody else for many biennia, and this is just another one of those good bills to honor our veterans.
Great, thank you, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and honorable colleague committee members. I'm Gene, for the record, Gene Wisnant, State Representative, House District 53. I have beside me today a person that has worked so hard and for so long in being sure that we recognize and honor our veterans. And this bill specifically talks about Medal of Honor communities and cities. Let me introduce to the committee and ask for your support of House Concurrent Resolution 1, Lieutenant Colonel Dick Tobiasen, a leader for veterans in all the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Representative Huffman and Representative Wisnant. Madam Chair and distinguished members, I am Dick Tobiasen. I'm the chairman of the Bend Heroes Foundation, a nonprofit organization in Bend honoring veterans and first responders. I'm a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and a two-tour Vietnam veteran and member of the American Legion, Military Officers Association of America, Military Order of the Purple Heart, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and Vietnam Veterans of America. I was to be accompanied by our nation's oldest living Medal of Honor recipient, Bob Maxwell from Bend, but at age 96, he's had a little bit of a health problem in the last couple of days, so he sends his best regards, and he says, please vote on it, and please vote in the affirmative. Our mailing address is in the record. It is an honor for me to testify to you today in support of HCR 1. HB 2100, which will be a public hearing in a few minutes upstairs, designates Interstate 5 and Interstate 205 as the Oregon Medal of Honor Highway. And you have to have that bill in order to have HCR 1 work, which is it's a vehicle for requiring ODOT to install Medal of Honor city and community markers, not signs, markers in or near the 11 communities listed in HCR 1. We will testify in a few moments upstairs with my dear friends on the left and right. We thank Representative Huffman and Senator Tim Knope for their leadership sponsoring HCR 1 and HB 2100 and previous legislation honoring veterans with memorial highways across Oregon. We're the only state in the United States that's done every war from World War I to the present with border-to-border highways. Bend Heroes Foundation requested HCR 1 and HB 2100 to complete the concept we envisioned 12 years ago that would honor Oregon's 500,000 war veterans and Oregon's 26 Medal of Honor recipients, our nation's highest award for military valor above and beyond the call of duty. To receive this award, the recipient had to have risked his or her life to save others during war. More than half of our nation's 3,498 recipients died as a result of their unselfish and courageous acts of heroism saving others. I should say that Representative Huffman and Representative Wisnant are very close and dear friends of Mr. Maxwell. I wish he could be here today because you're seeing probably the Representative McLean, you know Bob, and it's he is the epitome of a hero that was willing to lay down his life to save others, and he did. And he was lucky that he lived through that trauma 70 years ago. Mr. Maxwell was awarded the Medal of Honor for heroism during World War II when he saved his three comrades from certain death by hurling himself on a German hand grenade thrown into their midst on September 7, 1944 in Besançon, France. He received two Silver Stars, a Bronze Star, two Purple Hearts, French Croix de Guerre, and French Legion of Honor during World War II. He was drafted from Colorado, and he's regarded as the most highly decorated veteran of all time from Colorado. Oregon's 26 Medal of Honor recipients earned the medal during 8 wars in 10 countries over 108 years, beginning with the Civil War and ending with Vietnam. The honors to these war heroes, future recipients, and any Medal of Honor recipient traveling in Oregon would be accomplished with the installation of ODOT-approved Oregon Medal of Honor highway signs on I-5 and I-205, that's HB-2100, and Medal of Honor city or community markets in or near their cities, 11 cities that are identified in HCR1. Slide one here shows you the Medal of Honor highway. That would be I-5. And the next slide is what a sign could look like. This is just an artist concept. It is not anything that ODOT has seen. But it would the bills require that the Medals of Honor medals, in fact, be depicted on the sign, just like we do Purple Heart Trail signs on I-5, and it would say Medal of Honor Highway. And these would be the Medal of Honor cities. So you can see they're spread across Oregon. There are 11 cities to which 26 Medal of Honor recipients are connected, whether that was their home of record, whether they lived there after they received the award, or whether they were laid to rest there. So they're in all four corners, and so each of those would be the Medal of Honor cities or communities. Agnes is not a city, it's unincorporated, so it'd be a community. But there they are. So some of the markers would actually have more than one name, and the bill provides for that. So ODOT can determine how many names go on a sign and how many signs this community receives. But for instance, here is Portland with 12 Medal of Honor recipients all the way from the Civil War to Vietnam. So that would be a typical sign. But it would be more of a marker. It would not be on a highway. These would not be on highways where people are limited in what they can see. They go by in 2 or 3 seconds. These are places where people would visit. For instance, this could be at the Willamette National Cemetery where 4 recipients are laid to rest. So this would be something that might even be made of granite. If I were to ask the Willamette National Cemetery permission to put it there, they'd say it's got to be like everything else. It's got to be granite. So it's not going to be inexpensive. And that's not something that ODOT would do. I think that's something we would have to clarify that who does what. But on the bottom, you might notice it has a QR code, and that QR code actually works, and it would refer people with smartphones to the Medal of Honor Society website so where they could look up the details of each one of those recipients. They could read their citation, what war and whatnot. So we want to do that. So some of the cities would have a sign with one name, like Bob Maxwell from Bend. He's the only recipient tied to Bend, and then some cities would have two. For instance, Eugene and Salem would have two names on the sign, and the Dalles would have 3 names, your area, sir, and Portland would have the 12 names you just saw. The last slide is, who are these folks? Well, you can see there's 8 wars. By the way, the ACR, I wrote it incorrectly. It's not 7 wars, it's 8. We probably ought to correct that. But there they are, 8 wars from the Civil War to Vietnam, and then you can see by city who the Medal of Honor recipient is connected with. For instance, Agnes has 1, and then you go all the way down to Portland has 12, and in between are the rest of them. So that accounts for all 26. So all 26 are connected with those 11 cities. Each city would get at least one marker. I have, for the record, submitted more information as to the name of each individual recipient and each city. There's only one place in the United States where this has been done. That's Gainesville, Texas. It's a Medal of Honor host city. Otherwise, nobody's done it. And here we are again doing something first in Oregon, like we've done all those 6 highways. Thank you, sir. And you. We've done those 6 highways. No one has done that in the United States. No one has connected a Purple Heart Trail to its adjacent states have the first continuous Purple Heart Trail across the United States in any direction. So we've done that. So we did ask to have the markers include the actual medal so that whoever makes the signs, the law would say that you have to incorporate the medals. There's one for each service. The Army is on the left. The Navy and Marines share the one in the center, and the Air Force is on the right. So those would be depicted on the markers as well as the highway signs. Our objective is not only to honor the recipients themselves. I actually built a memorial at Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum for the 26 recipients, and these gentlemen here helped me dedicate it, and with Mr. Maxwell. But we want the public to understand something about the Medal of Honor because it's a very rarely seen award. Very few people have ever met a recipient. I happen to be Mr. Maxwell's agent, and I've known him for 12 years. You're blessed to be in the presence of these people. And I'll always tell you, other people did the same thing. They should have gotten a medal, but they were not witnessed. You have to have two. It's a very stringent requirement. If you were not to have performed that act of valor, you would never be criticized for it. But so we're very fortunate to have had those 26 recipients in our state. There are only 77 living Medal of Honor recipients from all wars in our nation, and Mr. Maxwell is the only one that's alive, I mean, the only one living in Oregon, and he's the only, and he's the eldest of all 77. 42 million veterans have served our nation, including the gentleman on my left and right. Of those 42 million, only one in 12,000 ever was awarded the Medal of Honor. It's a very rare award. And as we did for the other highways I mentioned, we would work with ODOT on the design of the markers and signs. We would, on the locations as well, because as we did in all the others, we paid for them. The taxpayers never paid for these. We raised $72,000 to pay for the signs that we now have, the 67 signs on those highways. But we would go out for these particular markers that are historical, that aren't highway signs. They're markers. We, for instance, Edward Allworth, World War I, graduated from OSU, then went off to war in France, got the medal, came back and worked for 38 years at OSU, ran the Memorial Union. We would like to put the marker near there. And so we would have to talk to the university, get permission. Same thing with Willamette National Cemetery. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has a wonderful veterans park behind the building. We'd like to put a marker there. So that would be a place for the two recipients from Salem. So we'd raise the money. It's going to be about $25,000 and about 15,000 of the 25,000 is just for the 11 markers for the Medal of Honor cities. We thank you very much for listening to us this afternoon, and Mr. Maxwell asks you to pass this bill.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you for the generous time that the committee has given us. We appreciate it. I want to reiterate two things. One, Dick is an expert at working with ODOT and all the agencies to get this done, so you don't have to worry about any I's not being dotted, T's not crossed. There's no taxpayer money. There's no fiscal. Dick and the veteran service organizations take care of all of the funding on this. And also, I want to point out it's very important. One of the most important things that Dick said in his testimony, Medal of Honor recipients, it's awarded. They are not winners. I've even heard on the House floor before talking about Medal of Honor winners. They are not winners. They are recipients, and the award is awarded. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I respond to any questions or comments you have,
Absolutely.
Please?
Questions or comments? No, thank you. And on behalf of the committee, Dick, I want to thank you for all your work on this project.
Thank
it's
you.
Fantastic, and I'm it, excited.
It's an honor. It's an honor.
To pass this
Oregon
today.
Should be proud of what it's done for its veterans. If there are a lot of other states haven't done as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on HCR 1.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved HCR 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Not. Motion passes. Carrier will be Representative Huffman. Thank you. We're going to continue, because everybody's got complicated schedules, to go a little bit out of order. Did I close that work session?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 4. I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 5. Invite up Representative Carl Wilson, Commissioner Lily Morgan, Sheriff Dave Daniel. Feel free to go with whatever order you would like. Just remember to say your name for the record.
Thank you. Chair Williamson, Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass, all of Josephine County. Nice to see all of you today. Thank you for hearing the HCRs. Coming from the small town, we can still say that most of us know something about one another, and that's generally a good thing. And these HCRs are reflective of that. I've lived in Grants Pass for 60 years and known a lot of people over time, and there is an intersection between myself and these two individuals in the HCRs. I won't bore you with that, but just to say that they're wonderful families. They represent well. And so it is my pleasure to introduce a couple who can tell you more about the individuals featured in our HCRs. As I say, I can always do that, and I'll have an opportunity on the House floor one day. But I'd like to take a moment to introduce now Sheriff Dave Daniel, who will say more.
Thank you, sir. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Daniel. I'm Josephine County Sheriff, one of the great counties of the state of Oregon. And I'm here basically to ask that we recognize two fallen law enforcement officers. That's really the goal, and that's why we're here. They certainly, in my opinion, deserve it, which I can go into a little bit more detail. Deputy Alice May Baker Moran was born December 14th, 1934, in Weimar, Oregon. She was hired by the Josephine County Sheriff's Office July of 1970. She served as a relief cook and part-time matron of the Josephine County Jail. Deputy Moran died November 17th, 1971, along with Josephine County Sheriff's Deputy Glenn Allen in an airplane crash into the west side of Walker Mountain near Merlin, Oregon. They were traveling with witnesses to make a court appearance. Ms. Moran, Deputy Moran, was the first female police officer killed in the line of duty in Oregon, for your information. As a side note, Deputy Moran's daughter, Rita, a friend of mine, was married to Josephine County Deputy Thomas Rice, who was another individual I wish to speak about. The question is, Madam Chair, do I go into 4 and 5 at the same time? Thank you.
Both hearings are open.
So Ms. Deputy Moran was the mother-in-law of Deputy Thomas Ernest Rice. Thomas was born on March 14, 1956 in Grants Pass, Oregon. Deputy Rice married his high school sweetheart, Rita Moran, Deputy Moran's daughter, in 1976. Deputy Rice volunteered with the Josephine County Sheriff's Office as a reserve officer until he was hired as a full-time officer or deputy in 1992. Deputy Rice earned the Star of Life Award in 2000 for his efforts in a river rescue. Primarily, Deputy Rice was a Marine deputy. Deputy Rice was killed on May 23, 2002 in a helicopter crash while conducting a search and rescue mission for an elderly woman who was believed to be drowned on the Rogue River. Deputy Rice's mother-in-law, Josephine County Deputy Alice Moran, also was killed on duty in an airplane accident, as I previously stated. Two tragic aircraft accidents. I'll end with that. However, I do want to give one last statement in the fact that my career in law enforcement started about half my life ago, and in 1995, well within the time that Thomas Rice, Deputy Rice, was employed. I worked side by side with Thomas, and he was a friend. So I ask that he be recognized. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. My name is Lily Morgan. I'm a Josephine County Commissioner. Prior to my new career as a commissioner, I was a parole officer for Josephine County for 11 years. And before that, a reserve deputy with the Josephine County Sheriff's Office, as well as a 911 dispatcher for the Grants Pass Police Department 911 agency. I found that dispatching wasn't quite enough to be able to hear the emergencies going on. I wanted to be able to respond, so I volunteered as a reserve deputy. But being Josephine County, we provide our own uniforms. So I was waiting for that event to come, and my very first day that I was supposed to arrive and work in uniform is the day of Thomas Rice's crash. And so that was delayed by one day, and so my very first day in uniform was the day that we honored him, and we had the privilege. I was picked to represent the sheriff's office as we lined the Rogue River on which he died, and all the emergency vehicles that were on duty in Josephine County, whether fire department, ambulance, state trooper, sheriff, or city police, lined that bridge diagonally, and all the officers stood at attention shoulder to shoulder, and I had the honor as my first day in uniform to be amongst them. to say the least, that my career spanning the last 17 years in law enforcement has been impacted by Thomas Rice's life, as well as that is Alice Moran, who I never had the privilege to meet, as she passed away before I was even born. But every year I attend the Law Enforcement Memorial in Grants Pass to honor both of them. And being a female in law enforcement, and at times when I was a reserve, the only female reserve deputy, her life was significant to mine. More so, Thomas graduated high school with my father. And so I can't think of him without also thinking of the impact in my own family. I've had the privilege of attending 2 years ago the law enforcement memorial ceremony at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, where our governor spoke at that event that honored Mr. Rice as well. I thank you for considering both of these deputies and their life and the sacrifice that they've given. I recently, last month, lost two family members, a father and a son, swept to sea. I can tell you, please forgive me, I can tell you it's no insignificant loss to lose a parent and a child. And here this family has lost a parent and a son-in-law, both in a crash, airline crash. So thank you for your service to Oregon, and thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to honor these two deputies and their amazing lives. I can tell you one side note. Rita continues to this day to attend the memorial every year. She still is impacted by this and will forever be. So thank you.
Chair Williamson, nice to see you again. My name is Mary Nunnenkamp. I'm with the Oregon Law Enforcement Memorial Trust. We're going to just scooch here so I can.
All right.
Although I can yell, but I won't. I represent a nonprofit that has members, including Malheur County Sheriff Brian Wolf. He represents the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Retired Hubbard Police Chief David Dryden. He represents the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. Lynn County Sheriff's Office Senior Deputy Chris Hodick, representing the Oregon Peace Officers Association, and Mr. Jim Whitehead. He is a parent survivor of Multnomah County Sheriff's Office Reserve Mark Whitehead, killed in the line of duty, and he is also the director of the Oregon Chapter of Concerns of Police Survivors. I am also a proud retiree of the Washington County Sheriff's Office. You have my formal statement there. What I would like to say to you from the heart is, over the last 8 years, I've had the opportunity to get to know Rita, and over the last year of working on this legislation together, she has shared some pretty remarkable experiences. A few that I've been given permission to share with you. The day that her mother was killed, she was 14 years old. And she became a parent to her younger siblings. And then can you imagine burying your mother in the line of duty and then your husband? When we started talking about this legislation and that it would mean a memorial highway sign with her mother and her husband, I did some research. As far as I can tell in this nation, she's the only survivor to bury a mother and a husband. It's unusual. Clearly to have that dynamic. But what she said to me was that these signs mean so much to her children and then also to her husband's family. These are not a simple thing for us. We make a commitment in law enforcement, and the sheriff can certainly speak to this as well, that when we have a line of duty death, we make a commitment and we will support our families and our survivors for as long as they want us and need us. The way I look at these signs, it's another way to show our commitment to never forget. Rita has chosen an area down near the Rogue River to place their signs. And what our survivors are doing, I've worked on the last seven signs, is they're choosing places that bring back fond, positive memories. And that also helps in their healing. And for her adult children to be able to come home and grandchildren to see that sign, it means a lot to them. So I'm urging a yes vote, and I'm happy to answer questions as would the rest of the panel.
Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Thank you all very much for being here. I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 4. I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 5. We'll open a work session on HCR 4.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 4 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved HCR 4 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Carrier will be Representative Wilson. I'm going to close that work session, open a work session on HCR 5.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 5 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved HCR 5 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Representative Wilson? Carrier, I will close the work session.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you very much. This means more than you know. Thanks for being a part of it.
Thank you for being here. All right. Now we're back in order. I am going to open a public hearing on HB 2590.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2590 directs the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to issue grant to organization dedicated to addressing community needs related to the October 1st, 2015 shooting on campus of Umpqua Community College, appropriates money to DAS. There is an emergency clause on this measure. This measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Therefore, we do have a fiscal statement and a no revenue statement.
Excellent. Representative Hayden, kick us off here.
What's that?
You'd like to kick us off?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Williamson and Vice Chairs McLean and Rayfield. Thank you for the opportunity to come and meet with you this morning or this afternoon. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative for House District 7, which represents the Umpqua Community College area. We have come to you today in remembrance of people in community college that were affected by the October 1st, 2015 tragedy. This was the largest mass shooting tragedy in the state's history, which took place at Umpqua Community College, where 10 people were killed, including a shooter, and 8 people were wounded. Hundreds of students, faculty, family members, and neighbors were affected by this. On that day, I was in my district, and as the news started to break, I started receiving phone calls. One was from Speaker Kotek, and one was from the chair herself. Thank you for those phone calls. And immediately, many people in our communities went into action. They started to come together to figure out what we can do. Is it best to not go there myself and be involved? Is it best to wait? And as our public safety officers handled that situation, this started to develop very quickly a need for the community to come together and address this, and that developed into something that we refer to as the CHART. This was called the Community Health and Recovery Team. This was team members from the local community, from many aspects of government agencies, public safety agencies, lawmakers, and nonprofit groups, as that group began to meet routinely, daily at first, and then weekly. It has continued to meet to this day. And that has developed into something called the Leadership Council. There was a decision-making group out of the CHART group that was formed, again, with people from the community, how to address the midterm and long-term effects and how to help the community recover as best as possible. On your OLIS, you will see a presentation there that depicts that. We can go to the next slide here. Do I have the clicker? This depicts the college campus or the community with Snyder Hall 15 and the folks that were immediately around that. But we also want to communicate to you that a tragedy like that is not confined within the walls of the building where the tragedy took place. It spreads out throughout the community to our veterans to our first responders, a hard, difficult time for our first responders as they deal with this, and of course the families of the loved ones that were either lost their lives or were injured in this or affected by it. The local organizations all come together to do what they can to address the needs of the community. This slide represents the aspects of those that came together, the needs. I know it's a little bit small for you to read there, but it's also on your OLIS. The summary or the framework of what is going to be presented by local members here today, I have been asked and willing to serve in the capacity of a liaison between the TLC or the Leadership Council and the chart groups for future potential legislation or a legislative ask of this committee. And so I want to present this request from the perspective of this is coming at the request of the TLC. This is coming at the request of the members in the community that have been there, that have been involved with this. And they're going to explain to you what some of the systems are that they have put in place, what some of the systems are that they would like to continue. We have presented to you on your OLIS background information, detailed background information working with LFO, and we can get into that to the extent of detail that you would like to. We're prepared to talk about that, of what funding came from the community, what funding came from the state, from the legislative ask from last year, what those were used for, what funding has come from the Department of Justice and the Department of Education, and how those fundings will be laid out in the future, how they have been laid out for the recovery. So I'm just here to be a messenger to your group and let the folks that have continued to work on the ground there and will continue to work on the ground. The important thing that we want to stress, this ask is in addition to. We have taken a lot of time to parcel out the funds that have been provided, the funds that are forthcoming, and this is the combination of the efforts of the initiatives going forward that are not funded, that are left without funds to the community. You will note that the grants from the federal government spanned 18 months. Tragedies like this from history of other communities go much longer than that. So these funds are not these requested funds are not going to be replaced by any grants that we have forthcoming. So I'll turn that over to you.
Okay. Madam Chair, distinguished members, and thank you, Cedric Hayden, Representative Century Hayden, for bringing us together here. My name is Ann Kubisch. I'm the president and CEO of the Ford Family Foundation, which is based in Roseburg, Oregon, and was part of the community effort to really try and bring our community together in the face of the terrible tragedy, which you know happened on October 1st, 2015. And we've tried to be a convener and leader of the long-term healing and recovery that has gone on since then. I think Representative Hayden laid out some of the main issues. What I would like to ask that you come away from today's discussion with is 3 points. One of them is that the victims in this tragedy were more than the 9 who died, the 8 who were injured, the other 7 who were in that classroom. The Umpqua Community College is a community institution. It's not a residential college. When it happened at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, that was a residential college. What happened here affected our whole community, so that the people who were lost were sons and daughters, brothers and sisters of people of kids in the school system. They were neighbors, they were workers, they were co-workers, and so this was a community tragedy. So that's, I think, the first thing I want to say that I hope you come away with. The second is that the healing and recovery for something like this, a trauma that is this deep, is going to take a long time. And the reverberations are going to go on for a long time. And Pat Sublett, Dr. Pat Sublett, who's here from the Education Service District, can speak to its long-term effects on the kids and families in the school system and in our region. And then the third thing I would like you to come away with is that there has been an incredible community response to this tragedy. It is amazing how many people came together across from the public sector, the private sector, nonprofit, community, faith leaders, educational institutions. They've come together, and as Representative Hayden said, we have met initially every day, now every 2 weeks or once a month in this community healing and recovery team to develop a long-term healing and recovery program for our community. So we have this incredible consensus about where we're going in our community and what we need to go forward. And so the request that's before you is sort of lays out the full vision that we have, and it parses out where certain kinds of funds have come from already and still need to come into our community. I want to just begin by saying many thanks on behalf of our community to the legislative approval for over $6 million, which went to UCC to rebuild Snyder Hall and to put into place some new security and IT protections going forward. That is really important to us. The symbolism of that building and that site is meaningful for everybody. But I want to also talk about some of the other things that we have gotten, that some of the funding, so to give you a sense of the kind of funding and the kinds of constraints for the funding that has come in. So as Representative Hayden said, we became eligible for a U.S. government, federal U.S. government, Department of Justice, Office of Victims of Crime, Anti-Terrorism and Emergency Assistance Program grant because we were the site of a mass shooting. We developed the proposal for that. The proposal was finally approved 16 months after the shooting, and the things that were approved were very narrowly constrained. So, for example, they were reimbursement for overtime hours in the sheriff's office. So they took out of the bill a lot of the things that were really about the broad community recovery. So that was missing from it, and we got it 16 months later, and it has a 18-month time limit. But in addition, I just want to give you a sense of some of the other funding that we have gotten. There was the UCC Strong was the Victims Assistance Fund, where people donated from all over the world for the victims' assistance, and that was money that was directed directly to those who were victims. And there was a community group that was pulled together to put in place the procedures for distributing those funds to be as consistent and as transparent as possible about that. Out of the $1.3 million that has been that has been received so far, about $1.2 has been distributed now directly to the victims, the victims' families, and others who were injured and in the room where the shooting took place. There are some other things that you'll see on this list, and we'd be happy to try and let you know about any of it. But what I would say is that some of the things that are on that kicked into play at that time don't even appear here because there's incredible in-kind assistance. For example, in the DA's office, the person who did the most work is the crime victims assistance person in the DA's office. She worked nonstop, 100% time, helping those victims for the first year and even beyond. That took her off of her other duties in the DA's office. Our United Way office, the director there worked almost full time in sort of a pastoring role for all of the victims there. Our mental health system, which was terribly, terribly underfunded and had very low capacity at the time this happened, figured out how to kick in some additional funds and some additional in-kind assistance. We had assistance from the Red Cross, from the faith community, from the local government. The Ford Family Foundation, we estimate that in direct cash contributions and also in-kind assistance, we probably contributed more than $400,000 to this so far. And other foundations did so as well. So in this layout, I don't know if you see the spreadsheet in front of you. Basically, what you see is that the plan that we had put together, that's the comprehensive recovery plan, some of the donations to date, and please keep in mind that it doesn't include a lot of in-kind support, what has been put in by local government, where the state has put in, you'll see some of the public safety response funding and the $6 million that went to UCC. You'll see what the U.S. Department of Justice is covering and what it's not covering. And then we have the needs that are left over in red. So that's the big picture of what that is. It's really, it's got some key elements to it that are, include victim services, continued mental health and support for our community, other kinds of public safety, and I want to particularly call out the needs of the first responders. The first responders in our community, and you just heard some incredibly touching, poignant testimony from the law enforcement folks, the first responders in our community were amazing. They had never seen anything like what they saw walking into that classroom. And they had, and these were, and some of them saw people who were friends of their sons and daughters in that classroom. And they had to take them to the hospital, and when they were greeted at the hospital by the health workers, it was the same kind of thing. And they, there are some of them who are still not able to even go to work. It was just so incredibly traumatic. So there's sort of direct mental health counseling that we need, but also broad mental health counseling. And then there's still some continued capital supports. And then finally, we're asking in this some effort to distill the lessons that we have learned about what, how a community should respond and how a public system needs to respond when something like this happens. Unfortunately, I think we all have to be prepared for something like this to happen again. In this case, it happened on a campus. There was a campus system that was in place. We got incredible assistance from the University of Oregon Emergency Response Group. If this had happened in a shopping mall, on a street, there would have been no institutional organization to respond. And so we feel that this state needs to be prepared for something like this to happen when you have a crisis that is a human-caused crisis, as opposed to a naturally caused crisis, where we do have systems in place for how to respond. When it's a human-caused crisis, we don't have systems in place to respond, and we need to document those lessons learned. So that's the overview, and I'd like to turn this over to Dr. Pat Sublette, who has a real sense of the long-term mental health needs of our community.
Thank you. Thank you so much for hearing us today, Madam Chair and honorable members of this committee. Yesterday,
Can you go ahead and identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm Pat Sublette from Douglas ESD in Douglas County. Yesterday, I was at a meeting with 13 superintendents from across Douglas County, and one of them said, "What do I do about all of the children I'm getting in my door who have a diagnosis of PTSD? What do I do with that?" And I said, "I'll get back to you." You know, of course, I said, "We'll get people there as soon as we can." But honestly, our community was in a mental health crisis already when this tragedy happened. We're a rural community, as you know, and we don't have a lot of infrastructure to respond to the ongoing needs that a mass tragedy like this evokes and the prolonged needs. On that day, I was in the hospital because my granddaughter was born on the 1st, on October 1st, 2015. And I could walk out of her delivery room into chaos, but organized chaos. And the hospital staff was amazing. They would come off of second floor, stand outside the delivery ward, go, and be completely present for every mother on that ward. Every child that was born that day has been impacted negatively by that shooting because it's a community event. There isn't a person in Douglas County who doesn't know somebody who was negatively impacted. Our children have already had a limited system of support. Most of our schools are very small. They don't have school counselors. If they have a school counselor, it's a high school guidance counselor trying to get kids graduated. Those people are already stretched thin. We're doing what we can. We're patching things together, but we are in no way able to meet the needs. Anything we've asked for was taken off of the grant that's already been given. There's been tremendous in-kind that's not reflected in this, but we need your help. And so I'm here today to ask for that help, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Oh. Go ahead.
Thank you. Again, I'm Cedric Hayden,
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chairs. Just as a quick follow-up here, the reports that you have on OLIS bring this together. On page 4 of the report, if you want to go into OLIS, it has it all written out. And I just want to point out that we worked very diligently with LFO from our original $3 million ask, and then in between there, that the grant funding has come in, and that's about $1.2 million. Of that reimbursement was about $500,000 that will go out for services that were already provided, and about $700,000 will go out for initiatives for a short period of time. And so we've brought those two together. We've reduced our legislative ask from $3 million to 2.3, basically by that $700,000. And then we've reduced that ask to $500,000 from the rebalancing. So $500,000 from the rebalancing now. And then basically, and these are rough, but basically the grant funding from the federal government comes in for another $700,000. And then we would like to continue those initiatives and a few separate initiatives going longer term for the recovery, which is the balance of that money coming forward. So if anybody wants to talk, you know, offline or separately or get with LFO, I'll be more than available to go through this in whatever detail you want to. But again, this is in lieu of funds that have already come in. Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Representative Rayfield.
You read my mind. That was my question.
That's what I thought. Doing was reading your mind. Right. Thank you very much. I'll invite up Phil Kiesling and Paul Mason.
Afternoon, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Phil Kiesling. I'm the director of the Center for Public Service.
Hi, my name is Paul Manson, also with the Center for Public Service.
We'll be very brief. We were asked by the leadership of the TLC to come here and be available to talk about the one component that we have put forward in here, which is the lessons learned study. We were asked and invited down. We spent several days down in Roseburg going to meetings of the TLC. We've been working on looking at other communities that have been faced with these terrible tragedies. And I have to confess that though we have a lot of work that we've done at the center across Oregon with ourselves and our partners like Oregon Consensus, and my colleague Paul Manson, who's in the PhD program, has done a lot of work in emergency management and community resilience. We've never been asked to do anything like this before, and I hope we never have to do anything like this before. But the reason we were invited to look at this and to put a proposal together is, I think it's been very eloquently said by the speakers before, is that this has happened, and for us to not take time to reflect, to synthesize, to have candid conversations, one-on-one in some cases, confidential in other cases, and not try to learn the lessons we can so that it not only can be of value to the Douglas County and the Roseburg community, but other rural communities in Oregon that might be affected by events of this type or even worse magnitude, but also other communities across the country. This happened in a place that had some extraordinary assets that other communities have not had in terms of individuals and institutions in Douglas County, but it also happened in a place that lacked so much that other places have had to respond to these kinds of things. And so what we can do and learn the lessons from this particular set of circumstances is something that we think would be very, very valuable going forward as part of an effort to heal and to build the community resilience, even more of the resilience than they already have shown through these remarkable troubled times. So we're here to be available to answer any questions that people might have about our role, and we really appreciate the chance to come here today.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'll call up Senator Przonski and Representative Hurd.
Good Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Floyd Przonski, State Senator, District 4. I wanted to come and be, I was asked to be part of today's presentation because the UCC event occurred in the district. On that day, October 1st of last year, I was actually upstairs literally in a work group with the superintendent of the state police. Noticed that he continued to have to leave the room. His phone kept on giving him messages, and then he walked in and gave us the news. There's been a mass shooting, active shooter, at the campus of Umpqua Community College. Of course, my first response was shock. Knowing something like this is actually occurring, ongoing, not knowing exactly what it was, but it was in fact in the district. Many arrangements were made, and as Representative Hayden said, it was like a stop in time. What can I do? Where should I be, etc. Number of did make it down to the staging area for the police that evening to get briefed and then attend the first of the many community memorials that took place. I can tell you that what I saw was a community that was in need, but a community that came together immediately and that has not stopped. This is one of the situations, as you've heard, where those who were directly involved are not the only victims. You can count out the 9 that were killed, the 7 injured, the 8 in the room, as you've heard, 24 families, and some of those individuals that were actually there are still there. But it goes way, way, way beyond that. The response of the community has been significant. The Ford Foundation has been one of the main leaders. Because of the incident and because, of the, as it has been described, there was a lot of outreach from a lot of different individuals. Andre LeDuc, who is with the University of Oregon, was asked to put together a team. They went down, and they have still continued to work with them today. Mary Spoldy, who was the president of, or is currently still the president of LCC in the process of retiring, she was also asked as part of the network of the community colleges and actually went down and took some of her key individuals, administrators, to help the school to be able to go forward. That there helped in the sense of trying to maintain the integrity of the college and helping with the community as best they could. But the reality is that was only the beginning of what is the recovery. What we've learned from this, and as you know, that's on OLIS, former Representative Freeman has put together a paper for the presentation today. Unfortunately, he was not able to be here today. But it doesn't set forth what the Leadership Council of Douglas County has been doing and how we as a state have helped and their appreciation, and I appreciate the help that we as a state have done, but that's not enough. The federal grant process has worked, but unfortunately, as you can imagine, it is a stopgap. It is not going to take care of everything that needs to be done for the community, and that community is at least as wide as the Douglas County. And I would submit to you it's much broader than that because of the location. Many individuals who attend UCC live in other parts besides Douglas County. Now, this is one of those situations that when you look at the impact, and as you've heard from the Douglas ESD representative, Ann, the impact that is now being seen in children. And the PTSD, yes, it's there with the children, but it's in many other components of the community, and it is something that will need to be going forward. So as Representative Hayden said at the end of his presentation, and I would only direct you to, just for clarification, on the report that is put together with former Representative Freeman's, when you look at page 4 and page 5, you can see what the requests are. Page 5, in fact, does have the 2017 legislative request, and as it's been framed, really what we're first trying to do is take care of what we can get through this process, the rebalancing of the current biennium budget that we have, and that is the emergency request for the $500,000. It does, in fact, have the breakout of how that money will, in fact, be used, and I would tell you, based on the coordination of having the Ford Foundation and the network and the council working together, these are numbers that are tested as to what is needed for these services. And then for the upcoming biennium budget that we'll be working on throughout the rest of the session is another $1.8 million that is roughly being asked to go forward. There is no way that we are going to put everyone hold. Just isn't going to happen. There is tragedy that has occurred, And what we need to try to do is try to do our best to help people facilitate through this process. And this is the time where I would say us as Argonians, we do what we do best, and that's to help each other. And there has been multiple times where we've had various type of events, many of them in natural disasters. Unfortunately, we have had some human-caused disasters and traumatic situations such as the one at UCC. And I'm asking for you to give your approval to let this move down into Ways and Means and allow it to be considered at that level for funding for these the needs that need to be ongoing. As we know, and this is the part I think is what many people are having a difficulty trying to do, is that after a while, some people say, I can't deal with it anymore. Enough, I just can't deal with it anymore. The reality is we have to deal with it. It is our important endeavor to do whatever we can in any community within this state where they have such a traumatic situation before them to help them the best we can. The network is in place. What isn't there are the resources to carry out that project. And this is where I believe we as a state have an obligation and we have the ability to assist. Maybe we can't do everything right off, but whatever we can do, we need to do. And so I'm asking you for your approval in HB 2590 to move it forward so we can give the resources that we have to these efforts so we can, in fact, make certain that individuals are going to have the services they need. And all you have to do is look across this country where you've had these other tragic events, and we know that it's not a one-year, it's not a two-year, it's not even a three-year limitation. This will be ongoing for many, many years, and by giving the resources now, the framework will be in place and supporting the network that's there already to ensure the best that we can for all those who have been impacted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dallas Hurd, House District 2. I'm going to attempt to not be repetitive. There's been great detail given already. But I just wanted to share with you more on my personal experience with this situation. As the Senator said, House District 7 and the Senator's District is where UCC is located. But for myself, Roseburg is my primary location and where I reside. Most of the victims and their families call my district home. And it's been a very difficult thing for everybody. It's one of those things that you try to bury down deep and not think about often because of the pain that's associated with it. One of the items I'd like to bring to the committee's attention is that oftentimes it seems like when horrific events like this happen in this world, there's tremendous amounts of focus and effort put into assistance, and all that is appreciated and all that is needed. But then something else takes our eye off the ball, and we're moved on to the next item. But unfortunately, for a community like ours, things will never be the same again. You can't drive by UCC without thinking about that issue on October 1st. You can't go anywhere in my community without looking at bumper stickers and signs of businesses and signs of people's lawns reminding you of what happened on October 1st. It'll never be the same again. I was fortunate to be an acquaintance of Miss Kim Dietz. She was one of the victims that lost her life that day. A wonderful woman. My wife and I were blessed to know her when we went to a vineyard several times that she was employed at. My son, I'll never forget, my son Elias, he fell and slipped. He had been about 1.5, pushing 2 years old, scraped up his knee real bad, and she was just such a wonderful woman. She just came up, picked him up, and took him into the house that she lived in on the vineyard and got him all fixed up, put a Band-Aid and Neosporin on him, and brought him back out, and he was just, you know, loving it up with her. And now when I run into her daughter and her husband, the pain that you see in these people's eyes is never going to go away. I knew those people before she was gone. They are different now. Now, granted, those are some of the most impacted people, but as the Senator referenced, the children, the adults that were directly connected, they need more help. I'm here to plead with you that you would pass this on to the next committee that needs to make the final decisions on this, and that you would pass on goodwill and support to those committee members as the legislature moves this through, hopefully, because our community desperately needs this funding to get us beyond the here and the now. Because it doesn't matter whether it's Sandy Hook, Columbine, Virginia Tech, or UCC, history shows us that these issues continue to go on. The wounds and the scars live on long after the first year or two. And so I'd greatly appreciate and plead with you that you would support this.
Questions? All right, thank you both. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HB 2590. I'm going to open a work session on HB 2590.
Madam Chair, I move HB 2590 to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair McLean has moved House Bill 2590 to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. With that, I will close this work session. Representative Kennemer, when do you have to go?
4:30.
Okay. So we, I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 15. So, that's you.
That's me. And then no one else. Is there someone else signed up? Mm-mm. Okay. May I just speak from here?
You may.
Thank you. The widow of the person involved in this is one of my constituents, and HCR 15 is about Oregon State Police Trooper William Thomas Levinson. He was born on February 1st, 1925, and he left high school in 1942 to enlist in the United States Navy, and he received a Purple Heart. Oh, excuse me. Okay. I think what I'll do then is I didn't know you were here. Let's defer to you, please.
Thank you, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Boyd, and I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police. It is my honor today to be the voice of Trooper William Levinson. Trooper Levinson was born in 1925. He served 7 years in the United States Army and served 4 years in World War II. Trooper Levinson was hired with the Oregon State Police in May of 1949 and sent to the Salem Patrol Office. On the night of September 7th, 1950, Trooper Levinson was operating a department motorcycle when he was taking some reports from the Salem office to the Salem Police Department. Witnesses have that he was having some sort of problems with the clutch on his motorcycle. He stopped at a gas station, which was adjacent to a train that was passing. At the same time, the motorcycle lurched forward, and he was struck by the passing train and killed instantly. Trooper Levinson was survived by his wife, Neva, and children, Pat and Rod. At the time, there were no state benefits for survivors of police who were died in the line of duty. Mrs. Levinson lobbied for two legislative sessions and received only $112 per month for her family. At the time, she didn't even know how to drive, and fellow troopers had to teach her how to drive. At the same time, Trooper Levinson's funeral was the first funeral troopers were allowed to attend while on duty. Before that, they had to do on their own time. Mrs. Levinson and her children are the oldest active members of the Oregon Chapter of Police Survivors. I want to thank you for your consideration today and your time.
Chair Williamson and members, Representative Kenner, I think you need to know that when I spoke to Trooper Levinson's widow, Teneva, she mentioned your name. Okay. And she's grateful that you will certainly help us and to carry this to the floor.
Thank you.
That means a lot to her. So thank you for your opening comments. We kind of surprised you, didn't we?
I'm afraid yes.
Good.
I'm sorry,
so thank you.
Didn't connect.
I've already introduced myself at the last hearing, so I you've got my...
I need you to introduce yourself.
Oh, Mary Nunnenkamp. Yeah, I'm with you. The Oregon Law Enforcement Memorial Trust Fund. And so thank you for that. I've had the honor of spending time with Neva, and she is 67 years as a widow in a line of duty death. And I got to be her chauffeur on several occasions, and many hours in the car of her stories are just remarkable. And I asked her one day on one of our trips to the police academy, And I said, so why are you still involved with the Oregon chapter Concerns of Police Survivors? And she said, when I walk into the police academy and I see all the widows, I want them to know that they too can survive. Just by her presence and by her wit and by her love of the other widows, she demonstrates that they too can survive. She has selected an area for her husband's sign in Estacada, and we'll work with the Oregon Department of Transportation with their rules and regulations, and on behalf of the Oregon Law Enforcement Memorial Fund, we are honored to pay for that so there's no fiscal impact to the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on HCR 15. I'm going to open a work session on HCR 15.
Just for the record, Madam Chair, we do have a dash one amendment. It just makes two clarifying references within the resolution. It removes references to service in Florence, and it clarifies the collision that the trooper had with the train.
Right. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to HCR 15.
Vice Chair McLean has moved the dash one amendments to HCR 15. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Madam Chair, I move HCR 15 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved HCR 15 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Representative Kennemer will be the carrier. With that, I will close the work session and I will open a public hearing on HCR 2.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 2 recognizes and honors Chief Daniel Duncan for his service to the state.
Yes, Representative Leininger.
Thank you, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38, and I am honored to be here today in support of the resolution honoring the life of Chief Daniel Duncan. Chief Duncan was very involved in the Lake Oswego community where he served as police chief. He was with the force for 25 years. He died unexpectedly in May of 2010 from a heart attack, and he's greatly missed by our community. And Lieutenant Daryl Risley of the Lake Oswego Police Department is here to speak to the merits of the resolution.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Williamson and members. My name is Daryl Risley. I'm a lieutenant with the Lake Oswego Police Department. And I'm here to talk a little bit about Chief Dan Duncan. Not only was Dan my boss and mentor, he had been a very close friend for over 20 years. On May 19th, 2010, Dan was in his office, which is on the second floor of City Hall, when he heard a call come out over the radio of a wanted person who had just fled the courtroom downstairs. In typical Dan fashion, he flew down the stairway, ran outside, helping look for the person. The person was found a short time later by another officer in the area. Dan proceeded to go back up to his office. He immediately mentioned that he wasn't feeling well, and one of our medically trained personnel started putting him through some tests, thinking it might be a stroke or a heart attack. He seemed to pass the test, but he still wasn't feeling well and went home early that day. Later that night, Dan passed away in his sleep. It was determined that he had a heart attack, and it was related directly to that call and considered a line of duty death. Dan left behind his wife, Deanne, son Danny Jr., daughter Dana, six grandchildren, a brother, sister, his mother and father, and far too many friends to mention. Dan was a big man. He was both in presence and heart and soul. He was respected by everybody that knew him. During his 32 years of law enforcement, he rose from being a street deputy in Tillamook County up to being the police chief of Lake Oswego. Substantial differences in communities. He treated everyone as an equal and never looked down on anybody or talked to them as they were beneath him. As a matter of fact, when he passed away, this was 2 weeks before his retirement. His plans right after retirement were to go work as a police lieutenant in Baker City, Oregon. He told me he wanted to get back to work in the streets again after 32 years. Dan loved the outdoors. He loved hunting, fishing, camping, quad riding, and riding his Harley with his wife Deanne on the back. Deanne tried the riding once, but she couldn't stay up on two wheels. Dan was definitely a family man first, who loved and adored Deanne, his children, and all of his grandchildren equally. Dan would had a reputation for getting off work and wanting to hurry home so he could see all of the grandchildren before his daughter picked them up because his wife was babysitting them. So he made an effort of that. But he never was in such a hurry that he couldn't walk through the police department and say goodbye to everybody that was still there. He made a point of doing that all the time. Dan was the kind of chief that cops liked. It didn't matter what help you needed. If you needed help writing a report or doing paperwork out on the street, he was there. If you needed him to chase behind a canine on a track, he would do it, or he'd jump in and throw his hands on the worst people in society just to help his guys on the road. And I can remember a time when I was on a call and I had pepper sprayed a wanted felon inside of a building, and somehow I got the worst of it, ended up blinded and had to retreat. I was taking cover behind a car and I hear a Harley come up. When you're in uniform and you can't see, it's not a sound you really want to hear. But then the next words I hear are Dan saying, "Hey, Daryl, are you okay?" He was off duty, happened to be driving by, saw what was going on, jumped off his bike, ran in to help, and then went and cleared the building with another officer. This is just the kind of guy he was all the time. A few months before his death, Dan was really concerned about one of our retired officers and his very poor health, and knew that he was going to pass away soon. And Dan wanted to make sure he got the respect that he deserved once he did pass away. Dan came to me and wanted me to put together an honor guard team and appointed me as a commander. We did that, and unfortunately, our very first assignment was his funeral. Dan served the citizens of the state with honor, dignity, and pride, and was the type of person that we should all strive to be. On behalf of his family and friends, I can tell you it would be a deserved honor to have a highway sign honoring Chief Duncan.
Very much.
Madam Chair, Mary Nunnenkamp with the Oregon Law Enforcement Memorial Fund, thank you again for allowing us to share stories of our loved ones. I think the message you get from Lieutenant Risley is that it's not how Chief Duncan died, but it's how he lived. I also want to mention for the record that in the audience we have in support of this measure Wes Lynn, Captain Neil Henley, who's a very close friend to Chief Duncan, and Lake Oswego Sergeant Jay Whiteman, also on the honor guard that was formed, and a very good friend of the Duncan family. Here's what I'd like you to know about Chief Duncan's widow, Deanne. And what I find really incredible is when they're in the moment of grief that they're in, what they do to help others. Deanne has moved to Eastern Oregon, and she has agreed to work with the Oregon Law Enforcement Memorial Fund in her efforts to decrease the suicide rate among first responders. She is our Eastern Oregon representative, and she works tirelessly to help us reach out and provide services and infrastructure to a part of the state that doesn't have a lot. Again, the Oregon Memorial Fund is honored to take the financial burden off the agency, the state, and the family. And we'll answer any questions if you have any.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions? Yes. Representative Barbara Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here and sharing the honor of the captain. May I just ask, is his widow living in Baker City by any chance? Wonderful. I have many relatives there, so I will look forward to perhaps trying to see her the next time I'm in town.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah,
yeah. Hey, you just know her, whatever. Yeah.
That's why we haven't made it over there yet since Christmas.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Again?
Sign placement. I forgot to bring that up.
Okay.
Want to add something? Okay. Go for it.
I just spoke to Deanne yesterday and the day before, and we were talking about sign placements because I wasn't sure on the procedures on that. And she said her first choice would be on Highway 43 at the city limits of Westland and Lake Oswego. if that was possible.
And we'll work with ODOT. Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. I am going to close the public hearing on HCR 2. I will open a work session on HCR 2.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 2 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved HCR 2 with a be adopted recommendation to the floor. So any discussion? Any objections? Not. Motion passes. Representative Leininger, will you carry this?
Honored.
All right. With that, I will close the work session. Any announcements? Any business left for the committee? All right. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you. Thank you. All right. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.